The rule of three states, things that come in threes, are inherently more appealing than those that don't. With the next generation GMC Sierra, Canyon, and Sierra Heavy Duty, we couldn't agree more. Whether you choose to have the world's first six-function multi-pro tailgate, available only on the next generation GMC Sierra SLT, AT4, and Denali models, to confidently take on heavy loads with the available 6.6-liter V8 Duramax turbo diesel in the GMC Sierra Heavy Duty, or to get behind the wheel of the only midsize premium pickup on the road, the GMC Canyon, you'll realize all three help you do one thing. Go professional grade. Step up to GMC and get 20% below MSRP on next generation 2019 GMC Sierra Double Cab and SLE Crew Cab models with a traditional tailgate. We are professional grade. GMC. Offer includes price reduction below MSRP and purchase allowance. Not available with special financing, lease, and some other offers. Take retail delivery by 9/3/19. See participating dealer for details.
Hi, this is Tony Ruggiero, the Dew Sweeper. You're about to listen to an episode of The Tour Coach, which is going to give you an inside look at coaching golf at the very highest level, from on the PGA Tour with my guys all the way to here at Mobile, Alabama in the Dew Sweeper Dome, as we help folks of all skill levels, all walks of life, learn to achieve their golfing goals.
Hey everyone, welcome to the Tour Coach Podcast. My name is Cordy Walker, one of your hosts around here, and I want to add a little bit of context before we get into today's episode. You find us in a room at the Pinehurst Resort. This is during the Golf Top 100 Teachers Summit, and we're in this room. Tony Ruggiero, our host, is obviously there. We have Nick Clearwater, who is the Golf Tech Vice President of Instruction. And we have Dylan DeGier of Golf.com from the Drop Zone podcast. And we just kind of had a really interesting conversation about teaching tour pros, asking questions about golf tech that, you know, I had, that Tony had a really great conversation with Nick. Enjoyed this kind of round table discussion in just a small little meeting room off of the conference center. So enjoy this chat. And we have more from the Top 100 Summit coming from you here on the Tour Coach Podcast, and as well over on Golf Science Lab if you're interested. All right, let's get into it.
So I'm curious. So Nick runs a golf tech, kind of the instruction side, the training side for coaches. And I'm curious your perception as an instructor of what they do at golf tech. I don't know. I've never heard.
I'll be honest. Not that I'm normally not honest, but like here, I'm really going to be honest. So like, I don't know a bunch, but I'll say that this. So before I met you at the PGA show, me, you, Matt Rudy, we all hung out and it was an entertaining evening, but like getting to know you, I think that teachers that don't have good opinions, you know, probably don't know you and your knowledge base and know less about, and don't take the time to find out. Would be my gut feeling.
Okay. Yeah.
Sounds fair. I don't know if that's, you know, I mean, but like, I think my only, you know, like I'm always curious because I have three or four people working under me. Like, I mean, how the hell do you train that many damn people? Like, that'd drive me crazy.
Yeah. Well, for some context, we've got 205 locations, about 850 coaches. And last year we taught 1.21 million golf lessons. So that's the scale. It's exactly the same. I mean,
yeah, no, but a little
totally
different than mine.
But yeah. No, so that's the hard part. You have to be very organized, very systematic, very structured in what you do every day. And it has to be a system that's simple enough for someone who's never taught a golf lesson but is super eager to do it. And that might be somebody fresh out of a PGM school all the way to someone who's had this is their second career.
Right.
We get a ton of coaches who have taught at driving ranges before with no technology or nothing more than just their opinion and years of wisdom of just experience, evidence-based practice experience, really. And then they have to come to us and we've got to be able to educate them to sit at a computer, talk to a student, have a launch monitor and motion measurement data, like a similar to K-Vest is really what we use, 6 degrees of freedom, two sensor system that every coach uses in every lesson, and two cameras that are shooting 120 frames per second and 1080p. And all this stuff is going on really fast all day long. So the answer really is everything has to be organized and it has to be a really high level of efficacy before we teach somebody to do something to keep them out of the fringes and off the fray little pieces about what you could spend your whole day trying to help people do that isn't going to help them play better.
Like I like the structure. So I have a young guy that teaches for me, Eazy-E. Mm-hmm. You know Eazy-E. I mean, there's a reason Eazy-E has a nickname, right?
And I like him already.
He's great. But like, so I was
having,
He's got a boat that he bought off another cart boy. I mean, it's a long story, right? So only in Alabama. But I had a sit down with him the other day about like, hey, you know, so he's gained a bunch of knowledge watching. I'm like, you got to get out and watch other teachers. But then I was like, what you're missing is some structure to your lesson. And I think that's great for, I use young, meaning more like green in teaching, like yeah. Where you haven't like.
Well, you kind of hit it too. Like knowing things, having information mm-hmm. is not knowledge. No. That is like the path to it. That's the building blocks of understanding what to do. But like you could sit in a room with golf instructors who study various things. Biomechanics is so pop right now. If you've never taught a golf lesson and then you start studying this field of biomechanics and trying to learn about that, that doesn't mean you understand biomechanics. It just means that you've tried to learn a little bit about that. So we try to do the same thing with our coaches. You can't just know tidbits. It has to be organized in the system so that you can understand how to use that information you have.
I still have a copy of it somewhere, but way back 15, 18, 17 years ago when I started, and Hank Johnson, who I taught under, he had this thing that he gave us. I don't know if he wrote it or made it up or whatever, but it was the three stages of a teacher. And he said, you know, the first stage teacher teaches what they do.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
They just teach what they do.
Right.
Second stage is you get a system. And the third stage is when you can actually teach cause and effect. And not many people make it all the way to third, right?
Yeah,
more now, I think, probably with technology. But like, I was like, okay, so Eric, you're doing great. I mean, he's building a business, like, and you're a likable guy. And he's going to get pissed when he listens to this. But like, you know, but it's time to have the structure and go to phase two. And I think, and I think that where people, if they criticize what you guys do, they don't understand that. Like, that's good. That helps.
Yeah. We aren't even trying to limit someone either. So,
right.
Like, if you came to work for us, you know exactly what to do every single day. You just get some brand new tools that we provide and show you how to use your teaching system and all that information and knowledge you know and just use it in our system mm-hmm. to be fully capable of doing whatever it is that you want.
Right.
So, we're not interested in blowing up anyone's current teaching systems. We're just trying to get them to integrate together.
But I think the structure for the general public, John Q. Golfer, is phenomenal.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because, I mean, obviously, you know, I think it's, to me, that's way better than going to a driving range and a guy with no structure, no technology, and just his random ideas and thoughts trying to help you, you know.
That's a tough way to go through your day, and it doesn't work very well. It's not repeatable either. So you might be able to learn how to teach on a driving range and help a handful of different people with different problems. So someone who slices, maybe you're good at helping them. But someone who overdraws, it's tough to learn how to stop doing that too. So what we're trying to do is offer any student who comes in an answer to whatever their problem is. So if they slice, their coach is going to know how to help them stop doing that. If you hit behind the ball, your coach will help you stop hitting behind the ball. It won't take long. They're well armed in that. Those pieces of information.
So we talked about on the Golf Science Lab podcast, your study that you guys did. Fascinating and informs the way that you guys teach. I've learned a lot from you. We've hung out here a couple of days and I've learned a lot. I've really enjoyed it. Dylan, I'm just curious your perspective here. First of all, I like your choice in shoes. This is a good thing to talk about on a podcast, but
yeah, visual podcast. Yeah. I do have a good picture of us from last night though, that you can put up when we drop that one.
Perfect. What is your perception of golf tech? And like, what insights are you finding interesting from Nick here talking about this?
Yeah. Well, I mean, first on the shoes front, we had Brandel yesterday on our podcast, Drop Zone Pod. And in the middle of recording the pod, he's like, oh, I gotta show you guys this picture. Like, Brandel, it doesn't actually translate super well to the
right.
audio format, but it's interesting being here in more of a big picture way, because you see these, I don't know if clashes is the right word, but it's a clash of ideas, even if sure. it's not personalities. I think for the most part things have been cordial, but you see people that are so passionate about what they do work really hard at it. And then there's this, you know, contrast of some old school, some new school. But I think that you guys will know more about this. It seems like everyone is looking forward much more so than the industry would have even a few years ago. I mean, like, even the people that, you know, you'd say, oh, you know, this guy, he's not a super young guy, whatever. People are like still trying to push boundaries because I think you have to. And that's a long way of getting into what I think about golf tech. But one thing that I was talking to Susie Whaley yesterday, and she was saying that only, what, 10% of golfers get lessons, period. So I'm wondering how much golf tech is a competitor with, say, someone that's giving private lessons versus kind of a, you know, rising tide lifting all boats of if someone gets a lesson with you guys, maybe that's actually someone that just wouldn't get a lesson otherwise.
Yeah, no,
and then Dylan, they'd be more likely to get a lesson with other people.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that perspective too. And then 10% of people take golf lessons is the best guess that we've got. There have been several studies that have been done about how many lessons golf tech gives, how that percentage. And I've seen anything from 20 to 26% of all the lessons in North America. So that's Canada too. I don't know how great that information is, but it's at least a start anyway. So yes, I think that there's competition if you want there to be. But quite honestly, if we do a better job than someone else, I would tell that person, just do better. It's not that 100%. Tough to do. Just do better. We're offering a really good product. That's why we're doing so well and teaching all these lessons. It's okay. But I think that kind of competition is what makes the golf instruction stronger. But secondly, there's so many golfers in the world that there's plenty of pie to go around for everybody, and we're not even scratching the surface on that thing. So put all that together, and I don't see the competition or like a real problem.
I think that there's been a big push towards golfers know more and more that they should get fit, right? For golf clubs, irons. I'm a big proponent of that. But I'm not sure that it hasn't gone too far that way, that people are like, oh, you know, my game's fine. I just got to get fit for irons and I'll be set. When really, I mean, that 10% number, that's not a good thing, because most golfers are not beyond no golfer is past the point of getting a lesson and improving based off of that.
Golfers are naive to how to get better. So you're so susceptible to the marketing.
So this is a random question, like really more like, so you brought up that like, custom fitting. I mean, to me, like custom fitting and that area of like has grown unbelievably.
It's all the rage, right?
Right.
Yeah.
So you wonder if that's because equipment manufacturers, people spent so much money on it, right? Mm-hmm. So you wonder if we spent that much money promoting people to actually go get quality instruction, if we'd have the same impact on people going to get instruction.
Obvious.
You know, like if you actually had a real campaign where you convince people that, like, you know, buying an iron set of irons can help you, but like really going and spending $900 on lessons with somebody in your system or my whatever could actually make you better. Like you wonder if, like, if you put the same marketing dollars to each, like you wonder what the, I'm just curious.
That's what we do. We spend a little bit more on lessons right now, but the half of our spend is basically on 50-50 of each. So people come to us and generally want help with their golf hitting, I would say, more than anything. They're tired of slicing a ball into the trees or every time they pop up their driver, whatever it is. That's where they start. So we'll give them the education they need to get rolling on that. And then very quickly, we look at their clubs, but not to sell them things. It's quite honestly just to distill the information to them that you might be being held back by your gear. So we offer all the same custom works you can get at any boutique offering, except we do something a little bit different because it's not our bread and butter of how we make money and how we run our business, that we offer OEM stock equipment that the boutiques do not do. So we'll give you the same custom fit experience you might get at any boutique or Club Champion or Cool Clubs or True Spec that's in here. But we'll still sell you something if you want it for the same price you can get it at any big box store.
So see, that's similar, different. Like my model. I mean, obviously, I'm a small little, have a golf school, right? But it's similar, like, and I've done stuff with some of the bigger, you know, with some of the high end custom fitting. But like my complaint has always been like, so I teach a lot of juniors, right? Like what's wrong with me fitting a kid in a set of irons that's S300s that we just bend a degree flat and they spend $700 versus $1,200, like when he's going to grow.
Yeah,
right?
I'm in the same boat, even for amateur golfers. So
it's the same deal. I agree 1,000% on the, like, I think fitting and teaching go together.
They do.
Like, because I know, one, I know where I'm trying to take my student, and I've seen folks go into places, a lot of bigger box, but like where they just fit the ball flight on the monitor, right? Where that may not be fixing their golf swing.
Right.
You know, you may be saying like, no, we're not going to do this. You're going to learn to do X, Y, or Z, and this, you know, this fit works better for that. So that's why I think you got to have instruction and fitting go hand in hand. And I think if a person doesn't do them together, one side of the equation is not being done to benefit.
A lot of people come to us and they say they want 20 yards of distance with their driver. We can help them real quick, usually in a club fitting for that, but to keep it sustainable and really solve the rest of the problems that made them come in anyway, it's got to be a blend of the two. And we're not there just to sell golf clubs, so we don't close our doors if we don't sell you thousands of dollars worth of equipment every day. It's not like that. So we're just much more unbiased. We can give you exactly what you need without trying to make you spend as much as you can.
Mm-hmm. Nick, what's interesting after spending this weekend with you is your confidence in the product that you deliver. Where does that come from? Is that because like the evidence base, like the database of swings that you guys have and the research you've done with that? Is it because of the training that you take the coaches through? Like, where does that, like, yeah. You have a lot of confidence in your product.
Sure,
like.
Sure. So, well, I have to. I'm in charge of making sure that we're doing the right thing every day. Our company values are strong. We're really just interested in getting better and doing it with as much integrity as we can. So there aren't smoke and mirrors. Nobody's hiding any answers from you. If anybody had a golf question, I'm happy to answer it. Our YouTube page is covered with that. And then we're just looking to get better all the time. So I'm not too worried about that. We've also, because we're such a large company, we invest in our product enough to know if we've hired a marketing firm, as an example, to help us review our product and see if there are any holes or things we can do differently and better. We're always looking to evaluate it and see what's lacking, what's missing. And then they're coming in saying, you guys as a company and the structure and the way you talk about what you do, we have no shady sales tactics and your coaches are trained really well. The onboarding and the education is
no
sound.
Fun, no shady stuff.
They're awesome.
Wait, this is where all the fun is.
Yeah, Tony, this doesn't blend with your lifestyle.
Where's the scandal? Come on now. I cleaned up so much over the last 3 weeks.
That's my work life. You know, that's not the rest of it. But I'm proud of what we do. And it's mainly because we're always looking at it with a very keen eye and looking through the lens of how can we get better.
Yeah, I kind of want to circle back. We were talking about the differences, you know, in the like brand or today, you know, and then you talk about how everybody's here to learn and the environment. And I think the environment's changed over the course of the years of coming to these two. And I think that like, it's not just the presentations where people learn. I mean, to me, one of the most interesting, like the main reason I come to these is the peeling off and sitting and having a beer or a glass of wine with the teacher and talking about something. Or like, you know, I showed a video to Chuck the other night at the bar of a student of a tour player of mine. And that's like, to me, like everybody sees the speakers, but like, if you could actually go around and film all that stuff, it'd be fascinating.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you and I've before stopped and talked and you exchange, it may be 5 minutes or whatever, but like, that's to me for the way I learned is valuable as any of the stuff I watch in those presentations.
Yeah. I think that those, I mean, I was talking to, you know, I just had a very tiny role in setting this stuff up, but I talked to Luke Curtinine, who was really the mastermind, a bunch about, you know, he's worried about, you know, you only get a certain representation of people because there's only X number of speakers you can have and demonstrations you can have. But I was like, look, man, some of that's just inspiration for cocktail hour. Like, I did a lesson with Gankus yesterday on the range.
Was awesome.
That was really fun. It was really fun. But I was like, look, man, people just need something to talk about afterwards anyway. So if this sparks different ideas and different conversations come out of it, then, I mean, A, that's the useful part. B, that's the fun part. And my guess would be, because this is true for me, but with more technology over the years, people might know a little bit more what they don't know. And so then they're more willing to hear other ideas from, you know, experts that can fill in those gaps. Maybe that's not true. Maybe the more people know, then the more they just think their ideas are right.
No, I think it's interesting over the years. I mean, I've been coming to these things as long as Tony has, for sure. And with technology, the ideals and what people start believing in start becoming more synonymous. They come together that way. Tech really shows that there really truly aren't thousands of ways to swing a club. There are maybe 100, and there are probably only about 10 ways to really describe those very well. So with more tech, everybody starts looking at things more like-minded. So,
and that was
not as combative.
You take like one of the more anticipated presentations, obviously had to be Jacobs, right? In the golf instruction world, right? You had the two sides and there was going to be like a brawl. So as I watched that, I mean, I said, like, so that's just another way of describing a bunch of this shit I already told people, right? And it was cool to see it done. And it would kind of validated stuff maybe that I thought or knew. But, like, kind of like you're like, I think that there's, like, I mean, like, I don't know that there's any, I think we're measuring stuff. And I think we're finding out maybe why some stuff happens. But I don't know that we're necessarily reinventing any wheels, even though people are repackaging things with some technology in different ways.
Yeah, how you describe things, and then the kinetics, or how you apply force to a golf club, that's pretty new. That's not something that's even measurable on any sort of scale right now. Anyway, that's going to be a different horizon of golf, and that won't take too much longer before someone develops a consumable way to get that data. So that part feels pretty new, but it still comes back to the kinematics, which is how you move. And to be able to apply a force to a club, you need to know how to move yourself around. So it still comes back to the way that we've taught before. So any kind of description about kinetics is really just a different way of describing things. For example, you heard an instructor in there talk about alpha torque. Well, alpha torque's the same thing in the backswing as really radially deviating your wrists. That's how you'd apply that to change the torque. So you need to know both if you're going to keep moving forward.
Well, so one thing I'd be interested to hear from you guys is how you focus on narrowing down what you do with all this input, all this new technology. Because I spent, you know, I had half an hour to spend with Jacobs this summer at one point, went out to see him at his club, and I mean, walked out of there like I felt like I'd been hit by a truck. Like, there was just so much coming at me.
And it's like taking a sip of water out of a fire hydrant.
Yeah, exactly. Because
you tried that? You tried that?
Yeah,
I bet you did down in Alabama as a kid.
Because he was giving me information for an article, so he wasn't just treating me like he would treat a normal student. Because first of all, he was like, well, look, we'd be in here for 3 hours, not half an hour, and I would be more careful not to confuse the shit out of you. But that's got to be an issue now that you can tell people so much more, but your teaching is only as good as their learning, right? So, how do you negotiate that?
Your system's got to be simple or complicated. So, if I wanted to tell you everything I know about golf, that'd take us a few years to probably navigate that conversation and take some bathroom breaks.
And I'd be impressed, but I'm not sure
it's totally worthless.
Yeah,
it's totally worthless. Right. So I need to be able to say what's important for you, whatever your problem is or whatever your education level is in golf, period. Be able to say a simple message in small, tiny words that you can understand very quickly. That's actually teaching.
I always think that the best, like one of the real arts of teaching is knowing when to shut up.
Sure.
Right? And, you've watched me teach a bunch, unfortunately, probably for you, but like I'm never going to be accused of over teaching, right? And I think that, that's one of the hazards of technology for beginning inexperiences. They keep going with stuff.
Yeah, they don't know when to stop. Or
whereas, like, as you gain experience, I think you learn, like, okay, the student's got this, and he may still have hit a shitty shot or two, but like. So, like, you know, when George worked with you, I mean, there's a little bit of it, like, you're hitting bad shots, and people say, oh, you hit bad shots. But, like, some of that's just you processing it, having to work your way through it, and that's how you learn. I mean, and, you know, I think that, like, that's the art of teaching, is being able to assemble all that technology and knowing when the player's had enough and then knowing when to shut up and just let them do it. Because ultimately, they've got to do it.
So there's your information versus knowledge piece again. I think just the longer you start teaching golf, if your system's good, the less harmful you are.
Mm-hmm.
So you know to say, like, Lucas hits a bad shot. You've got probably two or three things that have been cues over the years to help him take curve off. One is he yells at you. The second one is probably his left wrist.
He's as easy as they get. But yeah, I mean, so like, and we talked about tour players earlier. And so I try to have with my tour players, I mean, here's three things you focused on. I try to not have more than that. And we know what their effect on the golf ball is. And I think that if you did the same thing for a 15 handicapper, right, it's the same deal.
That's right.
I mean, like I write on a note card for every one of my students when they leave the three things that they're working on. And I learned it early. Like if you took one student's note cards from all their lessons and you laid them out on this counter, there would be a lot, mostly the same three things. They may be described a different way. We may have done it in short game one day or, and then on a drive or the other, but like a person to me, these traits and tendencies don't change from week to week. Like the stuff they worked on with you, stuff you've always needed to work on. You just didn't roll out of bed and that shit was happening.
Yeah. You know? Well, I'm curious, do you have any, you know, I think of Justin Rose as a guy that likes to have a lot of hand holding, even on the, he might be playing well, but he'll still be on the range before a tournament. And, you know, he'll be checking in with Foley like every swing, like, oh, is this okay here? And do you have any guys that are more like that? You're more of the,
I mean,
more is less, or less is more.
So I think players, and you would, I think you like gravitate towards the people that fit what they want, you know? I mean, we just saw a Foley impersonation in there, right? You know, and, you know, so like a guy that needed that probably wouldn't be a good fit with me, you know, I think, but I also think that like, so like, obviously I've worked with Smiley Kaufman a bunch over the course of the years. We had a bunch of success early in his career and we're working together again. Like at times I would say he was a person that needed a lot of that and he shares a bunch of videos, but I also think as he, you know, I've tried to get him to be more self-reliant and be less dependent because I think that makes him a better player. But, you know, so I don't, most of my guys are all like, once they go to a tournament, like other than we asking about like which football game we're betting on and stuff, like we don't, you know, I mean, it'd be rare that I get a video, you know, unless it's, you know, like Lucas, when he's in Asia for 3 weeks, like that's a long time to be away where you don't have a lot of contact. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, my guys are very,
self-sufficient almost.
Yeah, I like that, right? Yeah. You know, and I mean, because like I don't feel like that if I don't hear from them, that doesn't mean I'm not doing a good job or they don't need me.
Right.
Like, so Robbie Shelton, and who's a rookie on tour, and, you know, we went to Key West together and drank a bunch of rum in January, and we played 9 holes together at Key West Golf Club down there. He holed out on the 9th hole to beat me, give me a bunch of strokes. So, and then we went to South Florida and we worked a bunch. And then he got playing good, and I didn't really see him till like I went and watched him play 9 holes a few times and went and watched a tournament, watched him play. But I didn't really give him a golf lesson until Las Vegas in September. But he got his tour card, you know, played great. But like, you know, it's like somebody called me when he played good in Golf Channel, or somebody called me when he played good in Greenbrier, and I was like, well, I mean, they're like, I go, yeah, I still teach him, but like, he's playing great. He just shot 62. What the hell am I going to tell him today? You know? And so like, you know, I like that in him. And now, you know, he hasn't played as great. Went to Birmingham last week and we spent a bunch of time together, and he's staying with me at the RSM in 2 weeks, and we're going to stay together and work and do that. And so he'll probably miss the cut staying with me and working every day, but you know, But
that next week, though, then, you know,
he's going to have his note card. He's going to have his note card, and, you know.
Have you babbling in his ear. He'll play great. We've heard it here first.
I caddy for him and missed the cut. I mean, I'm awful as a caddy. I mean, Lucas never misses a cut. I caddied for him. He missed the cut.
Oh, man. It's
only, yeah.
Well, I won't ask either.
No,
Dylan, you got like every tour player wants something a little bit different. Like Justin wants that camaraderie, that partnership, that leadership. And that's where Sean Foley excels, if there's anything, is that he's out there. He realizes that his energy and his friendship with these guys is just as important as anything, or more so then what he even bothers to say to them. Mm-hmm. So that's not my game either. I don't have the time to do that. Unfortunately, I've got a job and I couldn't go to a PGA Tour event with someone every single week anymore.
Right.
The number they'd have to pay me is so astronomical. So if somebody, a PGA Tour player, calls and says they need help or something, typically it's with their driver. I can help them pretty quick with that. And then I'm out of there. And then if you want some more help, maybe we can work something out. But I don't even really do that anymore.
Because it takes nowadays, I think, and we heard different people talking about, I think Brandle talked about the evolution of the tour teacher, basically, right? So like I went to 28 events last year.
That sounds horrible. That sounds so bad.
So when you have, but when you have guys at different stages of their careers, like we have a guy like Lucas who knows his schedule, and you have a guy like Sepp or a guy like Zach who was playing on a medical and he earned his way back, like, but they don't always know when to get it in. So you can't just like plan, I'm going to these events.
Right.
And so, but to what you said, like the personal aspect of it is a huge part. Like we eat together most of the time. I mean, you've been around it. I mean, we go.
To help somebody be responsible for their game is a real daunting task at that level. You got to be into
it. You're in. You're all in.
And I applaud you for going to 28 events. Rental cars, hotel rooms, airplanes.
It's glamorous.
Those are dirty and awful, and I don't envy any second of that anymore. I used to do that.
So. But I think when everybody starts teaching at tour events, they think it's going to be like,
I think it's awesome.
It's not Augusta every week, right? And it's not the U.S. Open and all that stuff. And even majors get get old. But anyways, you got to love what you do to be in it. Just like you wouldn't train the people you train and be as passionate as obvious it is when you talk about you what you guys do if you didn't love it. I mean, and for me, if I was in your job, I mean, I'd jump out this building, right? I mean, because like it, right? That's why, like, I always tell people, like, that's why there's so many tour teachers and different teachers, because there's so many different personalities.
Well, the biggest one for me this year that stands out is at Bay Hill. I was just on walking the range. Steve Stricker's hitting balls. It's he and his wife who's caddying for him. Next to him, because he'll hit a couple balls and then he'll just glance over his shoulder, because right behind him is Bryson. Bryson's got a dozen people. Each of them doing something, you know, not just milling around. Everyone's got a, you know, so-and-so's down lying on his stomach taking phone videos and slow-mo of position at impact, and everyone's got a job. He's losing his mind, and eventually Stricker just went over to him and was like, dude, what are you doing? Like, he was genuinely curious. He wasn't saying it in a mocking way, but I was like, there cannot be two more opposite approaches to this. You know, Stricker's just doing his thing. He's smooth and irons because that's what he does. It's what he's done for decades. And Bryson could have just about won the couple weeks beforehand, and yet here he is reinventing the wheel again. So he is a guy that seems like he needs constant feedback from
people. He would have to be right up there, and I don't mean hand-holding in a negative way.
Right.
Like, I mean, he certainly needs, or appears to need, constant information and affirmation about what he's doing. Like, otherwise you wouldn't have that many people around you all the time. I don't have that many people I like, much less.
Not be a good fit for you. Bryson might not be meant to be for you, your partnership.
No question. Like, if you picked a guy, like, now I know Bryson for being out there, right? And he played on the Walker Cup that Robbie Shelton was on. So I've been around him a bunch. Super. And I will say this, like, I think he had, like, I think people take that image and they like somehow derived a negative about it, right? Because and they take the slow play stuff and derive, like, away from that, he's as nice and genuine and pleasant thoughtful and like as any person you meet. Like, if I run into him walking through the locker room, he'll be like, hey, T man, what's up? Everything good? You know, like, but then he gets on there, but he's doing his job too. I mean, you know, and I mean.
Well, a lot of them are. It's interesting. Some guys like that. You talk about Stricker, Dylan. That's a good one. He's so comfortable in what he's doing. Nothing about golf seems fragile to him. Mm-hmm. He has a system. He knows
what works. That's well said.
Yeah. Other players, and I'm not saying Bryson necessarily, but the feeling of fragility. I've seen that way too much in too many tour players. That feel like at any moment. They don't do, when you see the players who are really structured in their regimen and what they do, like, I always practice this way. I always do this. I always show up at the same time. That's a sign of that fragileness that they feel. That's where we're interested. I'm pretty interested to see if like Brooks Koepka's temperament catches on here. I say that because there's a guy who has no fear about his golf game falling apart. Meanwhile, 120 other people out there do.
Right.
So when a reporter gives him a hard time about working out on his heavy day on a Saturday when he has the lead and he says, what's the big deal? I'm just going to walk a couple miles today. Anybody can do that. That hasn't been around in a long time. So yep. I'm real interested to see how the temperament changes out there.
Well said.
No, I'd agree. Like, I think it's going to be interesting to see. And to see, like, I mean, since he came on tour and started playing good, he hasn't had any adversity either, right? He hasn't, I mean, like, you know, like the PGA, if he blows that lead, could go sideways, right? I mean, that thing could have been.
It was going sideways.
Yep. You know, and I heard a great story.
That one moment, the Masters, I mean, he wins that thing if he doesn't hit a pitching wedge in the water. There's a little adversity there, and then still to come back and play so well for the rest of the year.
You know, it's going to be interesting, you know? So, like, you know, I mean, but unbelievable how great he's played. You know, and props to Claude for the work he does with him and DJ and those guys and Ricky, I mean.
And some of the work he doesn't do, like you were saying before, you know, sometimes it's – because Claude's, he's very visible.
Oh,
he's
for
extremely,
sure.
But I remember Koepka was saying, you know, he was playing so good in one stretch that he said, you know, I told Claude, you can stand behind me, but just don't say anything. I thought that was pretty funny. It's like, yeah, you know, you can be there, but don't try to help me right now. I'm good.
Right. I mean, sometimes, you know, the best thing to do is just stay out of the way. I mean, they're really good for a reason. And I think that, but like, yeah, I thought, like, I mean, I don't know that Claude gets enough credit for like managing, just managing players at that level, egos, and keeping them all placated and where like, and all feel like they're all getting the right time and all that is tough.
I got to bounce, but thanks a ton, guys.
Yeah, absolutely.
Nick, I'm sure you relate to this, but you know, he's asking about, you know, all this information. I think one of the most interesting examples is just watching, like, Tony brings like Scott Lennon, biomechanist.
Always bring smarter people. I mean,
dude, I totally get it. I'm surrounded by people who work with me that are all smarter too.
They're looking at the data and he's going over all this stuff and they're talking in the tent behind the golfer and they're looking at the screen and they're talking about all this stuff and, you know, the golfer's kind of doing their own thing. And then Tony will come out and say, like, do this. Yeah. Simple, one line, two lines, feel this. We need to try to do this. And all of a sudden the ball starts going and just like farther, straighter, the whole deal, right? So the idea is you take the complexity and turn it into simplicity to make things easier, to get them done faster. Yeah. I think that's the simplest way to
describe
that.
So you make this really complicated, like in the backswing, when the shaft's parallel to the ground, the tour average of the 200 players that we've measured that play competitive golf turn their shoulders 53 degrees and their hips somewhere between 20 and 25, and their shoulders are tilted 28 degrees to the left, and their right tilt of, or their hips are pretty level at address, and they're about six to the left by that point in time. And then their hand path is moving in some direction, and the face is a certain angle. So all of that could be said to somebody, or a slicer walks in, and you could turn their grip to the right and tell them to move their hands in the backswing. That's like that's golf. That's golf lessons. That's what a real knowledge is, instead of just bits of information that aren't useful.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of The Tour Coach with Tony Ruggiero. If you enjoyed this, make sure to hit subscribe, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you are listening to this podcast. You can stay up to date because we have weekly episodes coming your way with fascinating people in the world of golf instruction at the highest level. Make sure to subscribe and stay tuned. If you want to learn more about Tony, head over to dosweepersgolf.com. to get all the details on what he's up to. Maybe you want to see him, grab a lesson, or go to one of his camps, pick up his book, Lessons from the Legends. You can do that there. If you want to see Tony in action with some videos and other content, head over to golfsciencelab.com/Tony to get more info there. This episode was powered by the Golf Science Lab and was edited, mixed, and produced by Just Hit Publish Productions.
There's one thing, if you know about me, if you've listened to the Dew Sweepers, you've come to listen to me talk, is you know I'm big on loyalty. We give 100% here at the Dew Sweepers. We put a lot of emotional investment into everything we do with every one of our players. And the same can be said for our partners and the folks that have been with us for the long haul and helped the Dew Sweepers, help our juniors, help us get to our tour players. And so I want to give a special thanks to our sponsors. Our sponsors are, first and foremost, Buick, and our local Buick dealers here around the Southeast, Schrixon Cleveland Golf, who've been with me for over a dozen years and their belief and support of what we do here with the Dew Sweepers. And lastly, the folks at Vineyard Vines. The folks at Vineyard Vines love what we do with junior golf. They support us on the road. There isn't a better family or group of people that are going to help us look our best, play our best, and have more fun than the folks at Vineyard Vines. So special thanks to our sponsors. Please support those as you get the opportunity. And for more information about any of those, check us out at dewsweepersgolf.com, or you can always check me out on Instagram at the Dew Sweeper.